last, not say Shabbos, last Saturday night when we all heard of the news about what was coming towards us. So I decided to open the Haggadah on the well-known part of the Haggadah, V'hisha Amda L'Avosenu V'lanu, that the promise that Hashem gave us has stood for us for every single generation. And I noticed a commentary on the Haggadah on Motzei Shabbos, which I thought was very pertinent for Motzei Shabbos and through the times that we're living in. The end of the V'hisha Amda, the promise that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Abraham, that we're going to last every generation, and even though every generation is going to come up against us to destroy us, it says HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzileinu Miyadam, that Hashem's going to save us from their hands, from the hands of the enemies. And one of the commentators asked, why is it that it ends off HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzileinu Miyadam? I could have simply have said that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to save us. What's this expression that he's going to save us from their hands? And this commentator says, because sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, he puts us in a situation that we're literally in the clutches of the enemy in order to show us and to reveal himself to us in a way that we see that it's completely and absolutely from him. He puts as if the enemy's hands around our necks, and at the very last moment, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzileinu, he saves us from their clutches to show that he's the one in control and he's the one that's doing the saving. And that's why it says HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzileinu, not only does he save us, but he does it in a way that is actually from the clutches of their hands. I think we're very blessed and honored to have Rabbi Kahn with us tonight to give perspective just on the general time that we're living in. I'm sure it's going to give even a deeper perspective over the last few days. And before we start, I think it's appropriate to say two prakim of Tehillim, one perek for the future and hoping that there'll be better days and safer days for the Jewish nation. But also I think it's suitable and appropriate to say a perek of Mizmor L'Sodah, thanking Hashem for the miracles that occurred to the Jewish people this week.
I just want to briefly respond and support and to echo what the rabbi said. If somebody actually paid attention over the last couple of weeks of the Parshiot in Vayikra, learned your Karbonot well, and somebody also understood the Korban Pesach well, then you would see what's manifest and obvious, and that is that the Korban Pesach is actually a type of a Korban Todah. That's the nature of it. Although part of the bread part of the Todah, you have to wait for Matan Torah, you have to wait for Shavuot. But the fascinating thing about the Todah, I mean, it makes sense subsequent years, because if somebody gets out of prison, if somebody goes through the sea, if somebody was sick and gets better, if you look at all the elements that are brought down to why you would bring a Korban Todah, so that is what Yetzias Mitzrayim is. But there's the other element is that the Jews brought that Korban before it happened. They brought it in a very dark night. They brought it in a night, actually it wasn't a dark night, there was a full moon that night. But they brought it in a night where they were still in exile, and a night where there was still slavery, where they were still under the control of the Egyptians. And bringing the Korban Pesach that night was an act of absolute faith. I love the comment of the Targum Yonasan, which is found in the 19th chapter, Perek Yotet of Shemot, Pasuk Dalet. There it says that God says, I brought you to me on the wings of eagles. So the pshat of the Pasuk should be that God brought us to Har Sinai. I brought you to me. So nonetheless, the Targum Yonasan says, no, you saw that night, that Pesach night, I flew you on magical clouds, which were like the wings of eagles, and I took you to Jerusalem, and you performed the Korban Pesach in Jerusalem that night. Now, I hope that you realize that there's something incredibly challenging about that. By the way, if we're already in Yerushalayim, we're already by the Har HaBayis, we already brought the Korban Pesach, so then it kind of ruins the whole Exodus story. Like, then we have to go back to do everything else. But the answer is that, and we have to be very careful about this, sometimes Midrashim, and the Targum Yonasan is very much a Midrash, sometimes Midrashim speak about different levels of truth. And don't worry, I'm not going to get all postmodern on you and speak about different types of truth. There's one truth. But sometimes that truth is based upon historically something which happened, and sometimes that truth is based upon emotions. So I'll just stop there for a second, and I'll ask you, you can shake your head. Are emotional truths truths as well? You notice only the women are shaking their heads. The men are saying, what's that? So you need to have a conversation with them. But the emotional truth is that when the Jews performed the Korban Pesach in Egypt, now I can get technically, halachically, you're only allowed to bring the Korban Pesach by a Mizbeach. What Mizbeach? You don't have a... Forget about all technical things. Emotionally, they were free at that moment. Emotionally, they felt as if they were in Yerushalayim at that moment. Emotionally, they were completely free at that moment. And emotionally, they did what every Pesach Seder is supposed to be about. And that is that we should see ourselves as if we left Egypt. And they saw themselves as if they left Egypt. They saw themselves as if they left Egypt and were transported magically to Eretz Yisrael, to Yerushalayim. And that's what they felt. That's what they experienced. And emotional truths are truths as well. And that's the beautiful way that Targum Yonatan explains it. But what I didn't really explain, and what I just now did, was this challenge in celebrating, commemorating Pesach. I'm not talking about the physical work, which I don't belittle at all, in getting ready for it. Some people it means cleaning, some people it means packing, right? Which is very authentic. That's what they did in Egypt, right? They were all packing and then they left. So a lot of the Jews connect to that, so therefore to this day as well, they pack up and then they go and they travel. But that's not what I'm speaking about. I'm not speaking of the preparations for the Seder. Because, and I'll tell you a secret. I mean, you'll figure out then that my wife is at Tzadekis, but I'll tell you a secret. I've been offered many times, and a couple of times we did. I went someplace and was a scholar in residence and so on, and I did this in order that life should be easy for her. And she doesn't want that to be easier. She wants to have a family Seder, which is meaningful. And all the work is something which is just, that's what we need to do. That's what we are as a people. We embrace the work because it's worthwhile to seeing the whole family sitting around the table. It's worthwhile to see the children. It's worthwhile to see the grandchildren. It's worthwhile to be part of the longest running religious experience in the history of the world. And we've been incredibly successful at Pesach Seder. We've done it well, which again, you realize the secrets. The secrets are there's food and there's singing and there's drinking and there's drinking and there's drinking and there's food and sitting around and there are heavy ideas. And we have been so successful with this, of passing on those ideas. And I'm not saying in every case, in every family, in a perfect way, but we've been very successful with this. But we have a challenge. And that's what I'm saying, that it was very subtle what I did as I was introducing my topic. The subtlety is that our reality changes. And as our reality changes, our challenge changes on how to celebrate this. How in the world do they celebrate Pesach in the Warsaw Ghetto? How do they do that? And on the other hand, you could say, how could they not celebrate Pesach in the Warsaw Ghetto? Because that's what this is all about. And part of my thinking with this has to do with us today, this year. Clearly, it's been a challenging year. Things that we perhaps never dreamed of in our worst nightmares. And we're here. And we're scarred. And we're going to celebrate. And maybe this is a smaller case because things are not going to be, in a certain sense, so much different from last year. But things nonetheless are. And I want to point out, and over here I want to be very careful about this. I used a very bad word in the beginning. The word was evolving. So some of you should say, evolving expressions of freedom. So some of you can say, but Jews don't necessarily believe in evolution. But we do. We believe very much in evolution, especially when it comes to Jewish practice. What we don't believe in is revolution. Revolution causes pushback. Revolution causes schisms. Evolution, on the other hand, is something which takes place gradually and takes place sometimes in a way which we don't always notice. But there have been many times through history where the celebration of Pesach has just been completely, completely traumatic when you think about what was or what could have been or what should be. And I'm going to stop being so mysterious, and I want to start and read the first line of the Rambam here. The Rambam, at the end of the laws of Chametz and Matzah, writes, Nusach ha-Haggadah, here is the text of the Haggadah, Shanagu ba-Yisrael bizman ha-Galut. This is a diaspora Haggadah. Do you realize what he's saying? I mean, yes, it screams it off the page, what he's saying. He's saying is, if we were in our land, and if we had a Beit HaMikdash, and we were celebrating, we were able to celebrate Pesach the way that we were supposed to celebrate it, then the text would not be exactly the same. Now again, some of you can say, well, how can someone say such a thing? So remember, this is the Rambam. And the Rambam is saying that something's changed. Actually, I'm going to help you and point something out. There are 2 days a year that the end of that particular service, we say, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. Right? Which 2 days? Yom Kippur and the end of the Seder. And those are the 2 days that we miss the Beit HaMikdash the most. How in the world can we have a Yom Kippurim without a Kohen Gadol? How can we have a Yom Kippurim without the Kohen Gadol going Lefnai V'Lefnim and causing there to be forgiveness, atonement for the entire people? How is it even possible that today we just read the description of what the Kohen Gadol did, okay, and that's enough, God will accept it? Do you realize how radical that is? Which means it's really a different question completely. How did we survive as a people without our land? Because our religion is very land-based. How do we survive as a people without the services which God is telling us are so necessary? Atonement, Yom Kippurim, Pesach, about redemption. How in the world do we do this? And the answer is that Chazal got very creative. There's some evolutionary process going on. And I'm going to point out at a couple of random things. You know, one part of my head says to me that the shir today will be completely disjointed and maybe will make sense to no one other than myself, which is okay. Whenever people ask me what I do for a living, I say I talk to myself. That's what I do. Perhaps other people are listening, other people understand it. And the other thing is, I don't know why I agreed a week before Pesach to give a shir. I mean, I have to give a Shabbat HaGadol Drasha as well on Shabbat, and I'm preparing both of them at once. Don't even ask me how I'm doing this. I have two different files open on my computer, and I was preparing the two shirim at once. So the only people who understand this is if somebody happens to hear both of them, and I think there's only one person who will. So, it's a lot of pressure, by the way. So I'm gonna point out a couple of things which are just so different from what they were, and I'm going to say it again. Some of this is subtle. And some of this we don't necessarily would expect. But if we continue reading, it says, Kach, okay, this is the Haggadah, Matchil, Al Kos Sheni. Now it's interesting. You should say, no, the Haggadah really starts in Kos Rishon. And I can absolutely assure you that I've been to Shiurim, and the briskers are pointing out that the first cup is not just the cup of Kiddush, it's also the first of the four cups. So it's a lacha of Kiddush, but also four cups. And whatever din applies, for example, by the four cups, you need to lie back. If you didn't do aseba, and they're nafkamin, I can do that. You don't want me to do that, but I can do that. I know. But you pour the first cup, and that's the normal thing. It's a holiday. You pour the second cup, and that's not the usual. The Omer, and this is the Rambam's text, and I'm not going to explain this, Vivihilu Yotzanu Mimitzrayim. We left Egypt very quickly. Halach Ma'anya, and we start seeing a text. Now, this text, the Halach Ma'anya, notice something, we just now switched to Aramaic. Most of the Haggadah is in Hebrew. Switching to Aramaic is interesting because most of us don't speak Aramaic. But the Halach Ma'anya is actually a text which is almost impossible, and I want to skip a little bit down for the moment. If you look at source number 7, it's the Haggadah of the Nitziv. Now, I know a lot of South Africans, and South Africans are from Vilna, right? And the Vilna Gaon had a major student who was Rav Chaim Volozhin, opened up the Yeshiva Volozhin, and the Nitziv was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva Volozhin. By the way, I can tell you another thing about the Nitziv. He was actually married more than once. His son from his first marriage, his name was Rabbi Chaim Berlin, and his son from his second marriage was Mayor Berlin, who later became Mayor Bar Ilan. So I may be the only person in this room to have studied both in Chaim Berlin and in Bar Ilan. So I feel close to the Nitziv. And he writes, Kohalach Ma'anya, Hosafa V'Haktamazu. This addition and introduction. Right away, he called it an addition. What does he mean by addition? It's not an organic, authentic part of the Haggadah. And it's an introduction. L'guf Haggadah nitchadsha bivavel. It was introduced during the time that we were in Bavel. Now, why is he saying it was introduced in Bavel? So I'm going to tell you part of it. It's because it's in Aramaic. The people there are speaking Aramaic, and that's why this is written for the audience. You understand the irony now, because we're not in Bavel. We no longer speak Aramaic, and this was written in a language we can all understand. And what's the net result? None of us understand it. Good. V'sofa yachiyach. And the very end will prove the point. Hashtahacha. Now we're here. You can look back in the Rambam. Shatahacha is the Rambam's language. The end of the second line. Lashana haba ba'arad Yisrael. Shata hada'avdi l'shata da'atya b'nei chori. You're more familiar with the text, which says that now, this year, we are slaves, and next year we'll be free. Now we're here in Bavel, next year we'll be in Israel. So when the Rambam tells you this introduction is part of the text for exile, and the Netziv says this is a text which originates in exile, you understand exactly. Of course this is not part of it. If we're free in our land, you don't say this. This is, well, I'm not telling anybody to course anything out, but if you're free in your land, you don't say that. And the next line is extremely ironic. It's actually the previous line. It says, "Kol dich v'niyete v'echol." Whoever's hungry, come in and eat, which is a beautiful sentiment. It's a wonderful thought. Somebody hungry, come and eat. "V'kol ditzrich l'fasach," again, the Rambam's language, "yete v'yifsach." Anybody who needs to do the Korban Pesach, so come in. You realize the irony? There is no Korban Pesach. They're off in Bavel. And that's why in the next line, and now we're here, next year will be Yerushalayim. Whoever needs to do the Korban Pesach, this whole thing is an impossibility. And it really encapsulates part of the whole issue. And that is, how in the world do you celebrate Pesach without Pesach? And I want to now be even clearer. If anybody's familiar with the Torah, in the Torah there are two separate holidays. One holiday is called the holiday of Pesach, and the other holiday is called the holiday of Chag HaMatzot. In the Torah, they're never confused. Chag HaMatzot is a seven-day holiday which begins at nightfall and goes on for 7 days. During these 7 days, you can't have any chametz, and during these 7 days, you should be eating matzah. On the other hand, there's a holiday which is called Pesach. By the way, when it ends is not as clear. It begins at the time that you can bring the Korban Pesach, which is on the 14th in the afternoon. And by the way, from that moment, you can no longer own chametz. It's a different, separate prohibition. And Pesach ends, well, according to Elazar ben Azariah, it ends at midnight. According to Rabbi Akiva, that holiday ends in the morning. The whole time you can eat the Korban Pesach. By the way, just like other Korban Todah, which can be eaten to the morning. So what we have over here is a holiday called Pesach, which doesn't really exist anymore, because we don't bring the Korban Pesach. We can't eat the Korban Pesach. And then the commemoration or the celebration of the eating it, we have to somehow move laterally and create something which is meaningful and create something which is redemptive and create something which can somehow fill the space until the time comes that we can do this in a proper way. And what's interesting is that it's saying if this originates in Bavel, it could very well have originated in Bavel, that line, between the first and the second Beit HaMikdash. Again, I have no idea where the Haggadah text comes from. It would be very interesting, maybe someone has done it, to do a color-coordinated Haggadah. Which part comes from the Chumash? Which part comes from the Navi? Which part comes from Ketuvim? Which part comes from the Mishnah? Which comes from the Gemara? Which comes from the Bavli? Which comes from the Yerushalmi? Which text comes from sources we don't know? Which texts are early and which are late? Chad Gadya, by the way, is very late. It's not there in early sources. If you look at the Mishnah, this is in source 2, The Mishnah in Psachim, 10th chapter, deals with the Seder night. It says, Mazgulo kos sheni, v'kana ben shol aviv. Again, that's where the Rambam began as well. Pour the second cup. That's when we start our deviation. Over here, the son asks, v'im ein dat b'ben aviv malando. And if the son doesn't know how to ask, then the father teaches him. Rabbi Salvechik once asked us in Shir, he said, who asks the Manishtana? Is it the Chacham, the Rasha, the Tama, the She'ina, the Yelishol? It's a good question. So he thought it was the Chacham. Why did he thought it was the Chacham? Because he wanted to give a particular answer, which I'm not up to yet. If I remember, I'll tell it to you soon. But I could also argue, and by the way, the process of illumination. It can't be the She'ina, the Yelishol, he doesn't know how to ask. It can't be the Tama, because the question is too sophisticated. It can't be the Rasha, because the Rasha doesn't care enough. And he disassociates. So therefore, process of elimination, it must be a chacham. Of course, the problem is the Mishnah, which, by the way, he knew very well. What does the Mishnah say? Here, the son asks. What does the son ask? Can we be realistic right now? You pour the second cup of wine. What does the son ask? Son who's on the ball. Son who knows what's going on. What does he ask? He goes, why are you pouring the second cup of wine? Some people, they wouldn't ask that question, but okay. Why are you pouring the second cup of wine right now? Now, after you had Kiddush, what do? You go wash for Motzi and you start the meal. So that's what the kid should ask. But if the kid doesn't know how to ask, what does it say? V'im ein dat b'ben. What does it mean, ein dat b'ben? Einol de elishol. So who doesn't know how to ask? So therefore, I would counter and say, no, it's the einol de elishol. Aviv melamdo, his father teaches him to ask these questions. And by the way, what's the custom that we have? The youngest kid asks. Who asks? The she'einol de elishol. It's the kid who doesn't even understand necessarily what they're saying. But that's not my main point. It's just, you may need something to say by the Seder. And it's criminal to have a shir a week before Pesach and not to give you anything to say. But it continues and it goes and tells us what the questions are. Now, you all know the questions. I'm not going to ask anybody to get on the table and to say them in Yiddish. Right? But that may trigger some memories. And the father teaches, Manishtana layla zemikol leid. Shebechol leilot anu achlim chameitza matzah, layla zekulu matzah. Shebechol leilot anu ochlim shar yekarot, layla zemoror. Shebechol leilot anu ochlim basar tzli shalukum uvushal, halayla zekulu tzli. Now that third question may seem a little bit foreign to you for a very simple reason. It's in the Mishnah, but it's not in our Haggadah. Why is it not in our Haggadah? Because it was removed. Why was it removed from the Haggadah? Because it doesn't make sense anymore. Because that was a question about the Korban Pesach. Why, on some nights, we eat all these other things? And by the way, I do believe the question makes sense. If it's a smart kid, I'm going backwards now, who is familiar with the Korban Todah is eaten with chametz and matzah. So he says, whenever we come to the Beit HaMikdash, whenever we celebrate, you bring a Korban Todah, and we eat it with chametz and matzah, but there's no special law that you must roast it. So this is why all the other night times we come, we eat chametz and matzah. Why today are we only eating this tzli and not in any other way? But just realize there's a change in our tradition. We got rid of the Korban Pesach. Now that's really important. It's really important because something happened. When we had the Beit HaMikdash, it's not just that there was another question. The main event was the Korban Pesach. Everything that happened surrounded the Korban Pesach. I'll tell you another secret. We didn't talk as much. We were busy doing things. And essentially, as we've had less to do, we fill up the time and the space with more talking. Now, if that didn't seem to make much sense yet, I'm going to try to make that very clear as we move on. The main part when you went to the Beit HaMikdash was eating the Korban Pesach. There are lots of rules involved in it. And there was simply not as much time to do all the things that we do today. And if this, again, isn't clear yet, the text was not as long. The text has become longer over time. But the text also focused on somewhat different things. And that we've already seen now. We've actually already now seen two examples of that. One example of it is in terms of this introductory halach ma'anya, but also in terms of what is exactly said in terms of the manishtana. I'm going to give you another indication of this. So let's start like this. Eating maror, whatever it may be, by the way, and most likely it was lettuce, eating maror is a mitzvah from the Torah or not. So now you see how clever we can go on this. So by the way, the best answer for everything is it's a machlokas. That's the right answer on everything. It's a difference of opinion. The Rambam writes in source number 4, achilat maror ain a mitzvah min haTorah b'nei atzma. It is not a mitzvah by itself. Not everybody agrees on that point. Elu tzuliyahi b'achilat haPesach. But it's dependent on eating Pesach. Shemitzvah taseh achad l'chol basar Pesach al matzah u'morarim. That on a Torah law, you're supposed to eat the Korban Pesach together with matzah and maror. U'midirei sofrin l'chol maror levado b'layla zeh. And there's a rabbinic law that says that you eat the maror even if you don't have the Korban Pesach, real ancient Korban Pesach. By the way, just to really make sure we understand the Rambam, in source 5, it's the Rambam in Hilchot Korban Pesach. I could already ask you now, what happens if you have the Korban Pesach, but you forgot to eat it with matzah and maror? You didn't do the Hillel Shawarma, right? You didn't eat the Korban Pesach with the matzah and the maror. Will you yotze the Korban Pesach? So he just now said that eating the maror today is a rabbinic law, but it was a Torah law to eat it together with the Korban Pesach. In Hilchot Korban Matzah, source 5, Achilat basar pesach b'leil chamash la mitzvah d'aseh shenem avachlo da basar b'leil azeh sli esho matzoda rumim rechlu. It's a mitzvah from the Torah to eat Korban Pesach. And how do you eat it? You eat it with matzah and maror. Halacha bet. The ein matzah maror ma'akvin. If you didn't eat the matzah and maror, it makes no difference. Im lo matzu matzah maror, yotzu de chovato b'chilat basar pesach levado. Korban Pesach doesn't eat anything else. Avol maror below pesach ain't no mitzvah. There's no mitzvah to eat the maror without the pesach. Which is, by the way, really interesting. Shenema amorim yochlu. So now, here's where I get subtle again. When the Korban Pesach existed, when we had the Beit HaMikdash, we were supposed to eat it together with matzah and maror. By the way, I can say, you know, that the matzah somehow is a symbol of freedom, and I can say the maror somehow is a symbol of servitude, of pain, of difficulty, of bitterness. And I need to eat the Korban Pesach together, sandwiched, literally, together with the two of those things. But if I didn't sandwich it, if I only ate the Korban Pesach, I ate the Korban Pesach. But there was no independent mitzvah. Let's just say the maror came to the table late. There's no mitzvah of eating maror. There was no mitzvah midrabanan of eating maror at that point, according to what the Rambam is saying. It's only after we lost the Korban Pesach. Again, this is the way the Rambam understands this. Only after we lost the Korban Pesach does Chazal say, you know what? Eat maror by itself. It's mitzvah d'rabbanan. Very good. The Rosh gets into the whole discussion about the bracha. He wants to know if there's a mitzvah of eating kezayis. I shouldn't even tell you this. Is there a mitzvah of eating kezayis of maror? Or is there only mitzvah of eating kezayis because he made a bracha? Meaning there is no mitzvah of eating maror. It's only because the bracha is what created the obligation to eat the kezayis. We just now got into 6 different achronim, and we're not going there. Again, we're trying to keep this light, so stop it. But that's remarkable. That's remarkable that in the absence of the Korban Pesach, we need something else, and look what Chazal gave us. Oh yeah, remember that condiment that we used to eat it with? Okay, now eat that by itself, because you... And just think a little bit about this. We don't have that symbol of freedom anymore. Okay, we have the matzah. The matzah has to be eaten anyway, because it says, Be'erev tochlu matzah. There always was an independent mitzvah matzah. I'm sorry, we're going to get too technical on all this. But nonetheless, Chazal, in the absence of the Beit HaMikdash, created a mitzvah midrabanan, eat maror by itself. Didn't exist during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, at least the way the Rambam understands it. But again, what I'm pointing out is that things changed. There was a need for this. Why did they feel there was a need for this? I think we can all understand this. In the absence of the Beit HaMikdash, and we're not doing things in the completely authentic way, maybe we need a little bit more bitterness rather than the bitterness just being together with everything else, an element of something else. It becomes an independent expression. And I'll say it again. I think that's really interesting. And I'm not even going to go further than trying to convince you of what my thought is. You can do the same. Try to figure out exactly what Chazal are doing. But Chazal did something over here. I mean, if you look at source number 6, this is what the Rambam was reading. Amar Rava matzah bizman hazeh d'oraita umara d'rabanan. Umayishna mara d'chtiv al matzah umara bizman d'ika pesach yesh mara. Bizman d'leika pesach leika mara. That means that maror was only ever supposed to be eaten together with the Korban Pesach. There's no Korban Pesach. There's no mitzvah anymore. But Chazal went and created a mitzvah drabanan, and therefore, once there's a mitzvah drabanan, then there's a bracha as well. By the way, we make a bracha on drabanans, right? Hanukkah candles, right? We like drabanans. Yes? Purim. We like Purim, right? We make bracha on drabanan, but that's apparently what happens over here when it comes to the mar. Let me go and give you another example. This is an example of how something changed. The problem with giving this example is that there's a likelihood it's the only thing you're going to remember, and you won't remember it properly, and you won't understand me, and all this is fine, but I'm going to point this out anyway. This is good. You ready? Yes? In Perek Yud Bet, source 8, Perek Yud Ben Shmot, what happened in Perek Yud Bet before this? This is Pasuk Kaf Dalet. What happens in the verses before this? This is HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem. This is the beginning of the end. We're about to be told about the rules of disengagement, the rules of what we need to do to leave Egypt, including the Korban Pesach, including the Matzah and the Maror. All of this was just now told. Put the blood on the doorposts. This is called Pesach Mitzrayim. There are certain elements that we only did that one time and that we don't repeat again. But before it finishes, we're told in Pasuk of Dalet, Ushmartem et hadavar hazeh l'chok l'cha ulvanecha ad olam. You're going to repeat this, you and your children, forever. And you come to the land, Ashiyitein Hashem Lachem, which God is going to give you. Kasher Diber, as God has said. Ushmartem et avodah azot. And you should keep this. Now, what does the word avodah means? On three things, the word stands, Torah, avodah, gemir chasim. Avodah is korbanot. Avodah is service. Avodah is the service in the Beit HaMikdash. That you should keep this avodah, keep this korban. It's not just about disengagement. It's not just about leaving. It will also be about commemoration. And when your kids are going to ask you, now, I'm going to do something really unfair. I'm going to read it properly. And when your kids ask you, what's this service that you're doing? Vamartem, and what's the answer you say to them? I know what you're expecting. You're expecting to hit the kid upside the head. But it's not what it says. Vamartem, and you say to him, Zevach Pesach hu Lashem. This is the Passover. This is the Korban Pesach. This is the Passover offering to God. Asher Pasach al Padei Bnei Israel. Because God literally passed over the Jewish homes, B'Mitzrayim, B'Nogfo Mitzrayim, when he struck the Egyptians. V'Pateinu Yitzil, and he saved us. V'Yikod Ha'am V'Yishtachavu. And the people heard all of this, and they bowed down in rapture. Rashi explains, V'yikod ha'am, and why did the people bow down? Now, all of you know something. You know that this is really the wicked son. Rashi knows that also, but he forgot it here. He knows it. He'll tell you it very soon, but he can't say it here. Listen to what Rashi says, because it's absolutely unbelievable. V'yikod ha'am, why did they bow down? Al Bisarat Hagula, because they were just now told they are leaving. This is not blood and frogs and all the other things along the way. They're leaving. It's over. They're going home. Ubiya Ta'aretz. And not only are they leaving Egypt, they were just now told they're going to the land of Israel. Where do you see that? Vayaki Tavo Ela Aretz. Asher Yitain Hashem Lachem, Kasher Diber. You're going to the land of Israel. So far, two elements. Leaving Egypt, and you're going to the land. Ubisarat habanim shiulahem. And because of the children that they were going to have, they're overjoyed because they're leaving, because they're going to their land, and because they're going to have these kids. Now, isn't this a little challenging? Because don't we know that this is the wicked son? Isn't in the Haggadah the wicked son's going to say, Ma'avodah zot lachem? And why doesn't Rashi know that? And Rashi says quite the opposite. Rashi says, you're going to celebrate this. Can I explain the Rashi? I'm going to do something which is like intellectually cheap, because in any intellectual argument, you have to bring the Holocaust into it. So then it's unfortunate. Can you imagine if people were in Auschwitz? And by the way, I lost great-grandparents in Auschwitz. Okay, so just there's no, on my part, not taking away any bit of this. They put my grandfather on a boat to come to America, to be saved long before World War II. My great grandfather anticipated that there would be more. It was before 1920, and he got on a boat with my grandfather, took him to America, but they wouldn't let him in. They had limits of how many people could come in. So the boat turned around and headed back towards Europe. It stopped in Cuba. And my great-grandfather said to my grandfather goodbye, 15 years old. He pushed him off the boat. He said, oh, we'll catch up. They never did. Never saw his parents again. And the whole town was taken out. The town was called Prujan. The rabbi of the town was Rabbi, that when my grandfather was there, was Rabbi Leo Feinstein, who was Rav Moshe Feinstein's uncle, and he was Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather. But he wasn't his Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's uncle from the Feinstein side. But I know you like the stories better than anything else, but that's it. And the whole town was taken off to Auschwitz eventually. Can you imagine now that Moshe Rabbeinu is in Auschwitz? And the Kodesh Baruch Hu speaks to him and says, you're going to leave. And he tells the people, you're going to leave. And he tells the people this exact message. You're going to leave. You're going to survive. You're going to get your own land. You're going to get your own country. And then when you get your own country, you're going to celebrate your freedom by doing these things. And your kids are going to come to the celebration and they're going to ask you, what are you doing? So why is that a reason for celebration? And the answer is, this is what it seems to me. The answer is that mean these kids are going to be born free. These kids are going to go to sleep at night and not have nightmares. These kids are going to be born without all the heaviness that right now is part of their lives and seems impossible to ever let go. When they hear that they're going to have children, who are going to then be able to even ask, you know, what is this that you're celebrating? And you're going to tell the story, well, our people were once slaves, but we're free. But they're born free. They're born without those scars. And by the way, I know that this is a double-edged sword. I know that there's an educational challenge. I know that we have to teach these kids. But again, can you imagine if you're not a survivor yet and you've been through hell and you're experiencing it now, and you're told you're going to have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and they're going to live in their own country, and they're going to be free, and they're not going to have that same heaviness that you're going to have the rest of your life? That's the celebration they have at that moment. And by the way, as far as Rashi's concerned, that's pshat in the verse right now. That's why they bow down, because they appreciate this. Now, what's interesting is that we go and we reinterpret what this means. And we go and we interpret it in a completely different way. So let me continue a little bit, and then we'll see how much time and how far we can get. In source number 10, we get to a verse which refers to the other two sons. V'yigadet levincha is the kid that doesn't know how to ask. Again, that's how Chazal use it. V'yoki shecha bincha machar lemor mazot. Mazot is the simple son. God took me out. Now, I have a really simple question. Why did Chazal think this was a wicked son? Oh, let me just point out Rashi here. In source 11, Rashi says, why does he teach it again? Because there's something new which was added. That was about the wicked son. So Rashi knows that verse was about the wicked son. But even though, as far as we're concerned, it's about the wicked son, the people who heard it in Egypt, there was nothing wicked at that point. Do you all understand what I just now did? Not only are we talking about an evolving text, we're talking about a text which could be evolved in the way that it's experienced because we're standing in a different place. You can read the same chapter in Tehillim, but it means something different to you one day than it means the next day. Because something happens and it just changes how you're looking at things. And this is true about all kinds of things in life. And what Rashi is telling us, that generation, when they heard that verse, there was nothing wicked. Subsequent generations, that verse, something happens. And that's part of what I want to address. And it's something I don't want to go that much into, but I'm nonetheless going to explain it or try to explain it because it really seems quite strange. But let me move over a drop and let's look at in source 13. We have the Keneged Arba Bonim Dibritor. It's 2/3 of the way down, the end of the line. Echad Chacham, Echad Rasha, Echad Tam, Echad Sheino Dishol. Chacham Ma Omer. What does the wise son ask? So this is what it says in Agada. Ma Idut Vachukim Vamishpatim Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Etchem. What are these testimonies, statutes, and laws which the Lord our God commanded you? Now, what's the answer in the Chumash to that question? Does anybody know? I know it's not fair to ask such things. I mean, you could have just looked right above at source number 12. What she said is, Avadim Ayinu, the power of Mitzrayim. Remember Avadim Ayinu? This is where it's from. So, just in case we're going to get overly confused right now, stay with me for a second. This son, who's called the wise son, who is found in Sefer Devarim, Perek Vav, this son questions all of Judaism. Nothing about Egypt in his question. Actually, if you go back 5, 10, 15, 20 verses, you know what you're going to find? This is the discussion. When you enter the land of Israel, don't worship idols, don't make the mistakes the local population made. The land of Israel is a holy land. You can't tolerate all of this. And then you have to follow the rules. And then the kid's going to ask, why do we have all these rules? And you know what the answer is going to be? The answer is because Avodim Avinu, the power of Mitzrayim. So what do? We do something really interesting. We cut it out. Avodim Avinu, we put on the side. We take the question. We say, oh, this is a question of the wise son, who's actually questioning all of Judaism. And then we give him a different answer. By the way, it's that different answer that I want you to pay attention to. But remember I told you before that Rabbi Soloveitchik was convinced that the Manish Tana was asked by the wise son? Okay, you're gonna have to go like this and then go like this. He said like this. What's the answer to the Manish Tana in the Haggadah? Avadim Hayinu. So therefore, by definition, it must be the wise son. Why? Because in the Chumash, the wise son asks this question. What's the answer in the Chumash? Avadim Ayinu. So therefore, Avadim Ayinu is the answer to the wise son, and therefore you know that the Manish Tana is actually the wise son. Did that work for anybody? That was, yes. That's why he asked the question, so that he can give that answer. That was really the whole point. But we just now, it's like playing three-card Monty, by the way. Halachic three-card Monty. That's what just happened. Everything just now moved, but we have to follow what we just now missed. We have a question, and nothing to do with Pesach. The answer has to do with Pesach. We take the answer, we put it, we already used it in the Haggadah, by the way. That's why I gave you this whole long part of the Haggadah, the Manish Tana. If you look in source 13, Manish Tana, and what's the answer going to be? Avadim Ayinu. What happens afterwards? We're going to get to the four sons. We get to the four sons, and then we're going to give them answers, and that's, again, what I want to pick. But also, I skipped something in the middle. The Masa of Rabbi Lezer, right? The Masa of Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Lezer ben Azayin, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Tarfon, and that deserves a lot more time. I think that's what I'm going to talk about more in Shabbat. You're all welcome to come to Givat Zev for Shabbat, but that I'm not going to get into that much now. But there's something about this that I'm going to come back to, I hope. But first, let me go and look at our wise son. We have the question. We know the answer. With the wicked son, we turned into wicked son. We didn't give him the answer in the Chumash. Instead, we're a little abusive of him. Yes, do you remember what we say to him? If you look towards the end of source 13, what do we say to the wise son? He asked the question. We talked to him about the laws of Pesach. By the way, that's really interesting. Because if we're talking about the laws of Pesach, do you realize what that means? It means that we're either really close. You don't know what it means yet. Should I go back what I already told you? Once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, the focus of the Seder moved from the Pesach to Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. It moved from the actual laws to talking about it. It's not that we didn't talk before, we did, but it was much more law-focused because there was so much to do. There was much more doing, and therefore there was less talking, and then the talking ends up replacing a lot of the doing. Did that make sense? The question of the answer to the wise son, therefore, is really instructive, but we don't understand it, by the way. We don't understand it. We will in a minute, but we don't understand it yet. It says that what do we talk to about? Ein maftir nachar Pesach afikoman. Anybody actually knows what that means? Ein maftir nachar Pesach afikoman. After you eat the korban Pesach, you can't eat any afikoman. We think we know what the afikoman is. The word afikoman means dessert. You can't eat dessert after the Korban Pesach. It's a technical law about the Korban Pesach. It should be the last thing you eat. It should linger in your mouth. And that should be the taste that you take with you throughout the evening. technical law about eating the Korban Pesach. So why is that the answer to the why sign? How does that answer? So let's take a look. The questions of the four sons actually has a source. It has two sources. The real source is called the Mechilta. Those of us who don't know what the Mechilta is, it's kind of like the Mishnah kind of material, but in the sequence of the Torah, as opposed to topically, like the Gemara of Pesachim, this goes in the order of the Chumash. The Mechilta is in source number 16. It says, Nimtzet Omer Arber Bonimheim, Echad Chacham, Echad Rasha, Echad Tam, Echad Shein Adi Lashol. Chachamahu Omer, Ma'i Dut V'chukim, Ma'am Shem Tzifa Hashem L'keinu, Otanu. By the way, it's not a mistake. Do you realize what it did there? Otanu. It changed the word a little bit. It paraphrased the Torah. Because it didn't want him to be exclusive, because if he's exclusive, then he's not so much different from the wicked son. So he has to be inclusive, but what can you do? The verse wasn't inclusive, so you fix it, right? In those days, they had whiteout, right? They fixed it. By the way, don't get misunderstood. They didn't fix the Torah. It's a paraphrase. What's the answer? Afata pitachlo, that's the point which is not in our Haggadah. And there's all kinds of explanations what patach means. But why is patach to the wise son? Afata pitachlo behilchot ha-pesach, ein maftir ha-pesach afikoman. So what this actually means is, you teach him the laws of Pesach, pitachlo, from the beginning, from the patach, until the very end. Do you know what the Mishnah is at the very end of Pesachim? Second to last Mishnah is, ein maftir ha-pesach afikoman. At Petachlo, what do you do to the wise son? You teach him all the law. The reason why this is interesting is because this would still seem to be a remnant of the time that we focused on Korban Pesach, on the law. The wise son is interested to talk about the law, but give me a second, because the reason that this whole teaching is really here is because of the wicked son. Rashamau Omer, Ma Havodah Zot Lachem. Now, remember I read it before? Ma Havodah Zot Lachem. That's not what it says here. Here it says something else. Here it says, Ma voda zot lachem. Lachem velo lo. Exclusive. Ulefish hotzi atzmo min haklal, since he's separated from the community, vikafar bi'ikar. By the way, that did not make it to the Haggadah. And he absolutely is guilty of heresy. What heresy is he guilty of? By the way, the answer is you don't know. Afat hakeid etchinav, but hakeid does not mean what you think it does easy. It's with a kuf, not with a kaf. It doesn't mean hit him. It means to soften, actually. To take away sharpness. Kaheh. Means to make something blunter and not as sharp. You try to take away the sting of what he said. You try to lower the decibels over here. But there's a very strong message as well. Somebody who separates himself would not have left at all. And you know what? This is completely mysterious. Why in the world are we talking to this kid this way? On top of everything else, in the Chumash, it was a positive thing. In the Chumash, we gave a different answer. Why don't we just give the answer in the Chumash? What was the answer in the Chumash? It was, this is Pesach. God passed over our homes. God saved us. Why aren't we giving him the same answer? And the answer is because it's not the same question. So why isn't it the same question? Well, it's not the same question because of the tone of voice. So how did Chazal know what the tone of voice is? Don't get carried away yet. I just want to read one very quick thing. Look at source 17, and I want to read from the beginning, but we're going to stop at some point. Tanya Rebchia, Keneged Arba Banim, Dibur Torah. This is the Yerushalmi. This is the other ancient source of the four sons. Keneged Arba Banim, Dibur Torah. Ben Chacham, Ben Rasha, Ben Tipesh, Ben She'en Odei Elishol. Ben Chacham, Ahu Omer. It sounds almost the same. Ma'i Dudu Chachim, Mishvot Hashar Tziva Hashem Elkeinu, Otanu, does the same thing. Paraphrase, inclusive. Afata Amerlo, and what do? It switched the answer. Bechozek Yad Otsiyan Hashem Yimitami Beit Avadim. Instead of focusing on halacha, on law, it switches to tell him a story. Ben Rashamahu Omer, Ma Bodazot Lachem, Ma HaTorah Chazeh Shatamatrichem Aleinu B'kol Shana V'Shana. Okay, I have to read the question again, because it was a different question. It wasn't Ma Avodah Zot Lachem, what is this stuff that you people are doing? Now it is Ma HaAvodah Hazot Lachem, what is this service that you people are doing? So when I said it's the tone of voice, the Mechilta and the Yerushalmi heard two different things. So how did I try to figure this out once I saw this? And by the way, now I'm sharing with you the Dvar Torah that I said at the Seder in 1985. Okay? And those of you interested, this was my first printed article. Was about the wicked son in the Pesach Haggadah. But really what I asked myself was something very simple. The verse itself says the kid asks an innocent question. Dad, ma avodah zot lachem? And the answer is, oh, it's Passover. And we took it to, instead, by the way, two different ways. One is the Mechilta, one is the Rishalmi. The Rishalmi, we actually have a little bit more information. Did you notice what it was? It had a name, Reb Chiya. I know who Reb Chiya is, so we'll have to hold on for Reb Chiya a second. Reb Chiya lives at the same time as Reb Yehuda Nasi. Reb Chiya is the uncle of Rav. Reb Chiya is and Rav loved him so much, he actually named his son after him, named Reb Chiya as well. So this is Reb Chiya, who is obviously after Rabbi Yishmael. So Rabbi Yishmael hears something. So I have to ask myself a really simple question, and it's a historical question. And that is, why would Rabbi Yishmael hear a son who's being exclusive and taking himself out? By the way, so much so that when we read about the wise son, it wouldn't let him be exclusive, and it changed the text that he's inclusive. So essentially what I'm asking is, well, it's a historical question. Who, during the time of Rabbi Yishmael, would have been exclusive and would have had this kind of conversation? And this is another point. And this point we always have to keep in mind. The wicked son, even though sometimes we get into arguments with them and we tell them all kinds of things, they keep showing up every year. And the truth is, we're very happy that they keep showing up every year. And that's part of what this conversation is. Are you a part of this or you're not a part of this? So I'm just going to tell you my historical guess. What I'm asking myself, during the time of Rabbi Yishmael, what Jews were not part of the Jewish community? So you can try to, you know, historically round up all the usual suspects, but I think this is the answer. I mean, again, you have the Tzedukim, but the Tzedukim earlier, after the destruction of the Second Temple, they kind of lost any of the, because they were mainly temple-based. We could talk about the Essenes. It's also somewhat easier. You could earlier talk about the Bitusim, and it actually comes down to one group, okay, as far as I could tell. And that group was the early Jewish Christians. So let me just say one thing about them, and then hopefully this will make some sense. And I still have a couple more things to say before we finish. I know that you already want to go home. The early Jewish Christians clearly don't exist anymore. The early Jewish Christians were Jewish. The early Jewish Christians believed that Jesus was the Messiah. That's all. It's only later on Christianity tries to repackage and sell itself to pagans that it took in all the pagan elements. And at that point, Jesus is not the Messiah. He becomes God or a demigod or the Son of God or the Trinity or whatever you want. But the Jewish Christians believed that he was the Messiah, that he's Mashiach. Matter of fact, initially, these people were people that were keeping all mitzvot. First time, they're keeping all mitzvot. They're tzitzit out, if people did that in those days. I don't know if they did. They're going to mikveh, and they are keeping Shabbat, and they're keeping holiday. They're keeping everything. Something happened. The schism, remember, I used the word before, the schism that took place was that they decided to choose neutrality and not to side with Jews. Now listen to this point, because this is incredibly important, especially today. During the Great Revolt, the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, the Jewish Christians said that we're taking neutrality, we're not taking sides. Rabbi Akiva believed that Bar Kokhba was or could be Mashiach, and they said, no, thank you, we have one already. And therefore they refused to take sides. And the traditional response to them was, what are you talking about? Are you our people? Are you a part of us or not? Are you part of the fight for redemption or not? Are you experiencing Pesach anymore or not? And let's go back to October 7th and October 8th. All of us know, and I have to tell you this because we all know it, the amount of people who showed up to report to duty was more than 100%. The people who showed up were people, some religious, some anti-religious, some non-religious. And they were people who fought together, and people who were able to put all of the arguments aside and changing the Constitution. We have a Constitution. We don't have a Constitution. Getting rid of the Supreme Court. We love the Supreme Court. And all of those. And again, a week before this, these people were fighting about this, and they believed it was existential battles. But as soon as the common enemy came, we're brothers. And people literally put their lives on the line to protect their brothers and sisters. That was it. Nothing else. Our ideological, our theological, our political, our economic arguments all go aside because there's something so much bigger which keeps us together. And that's what we saw. And that's what we're still seeing. And it's scary that God had to remind us that this is so important. That's what happened over here, is the Jewish Christians refused to fight with us, and they said, this is not our battle. And it's that what Rabbi Yishmael hears. Ma avoda zot lachem. This is your battle. It's not our battle. And then they said, attitudes like this, you never would have left Egypt. And by the way, why am I so convinced that I'm right about this? And I am convinced I'm right. It's because I looked at Reb Chiya. Because what did Reb Chiya do? Remember we talked this whole time today about changing, the Haggadah or the Seder experience evolving, different situations. 100 years later, approximately, by the time we get to Reb Chiya, Christianity has changed. It has, by this point, almost moved out the door. By this point, there's rejection of all kinds of Jewish practice. And by the way, one of the interesting things is that part of what was rejected, and this goes to the heart of Christian theology, is they rejected Korbanot generally, and they rejected the Passover service specifically. Why? Because Mary had a little lamb. And they believed that Jesus was the Paschal lamb, and that Jesus died for everyone's sins. And therefore, and by the way, notice also what happens. Redemption gets changed from national redemption, and it becomes individual redemption. I mean, essentially, Christianity did not keep any promise of what redemption is supposed to be. Quite the opposite. But instead, they promised individual redemption. Just believe, and now you'll be redeemed. So therefore, look at the update what Reb Chiya did. Reb Chiya changes it to not ma'avodazot lachem, it's the point that you've separated. Rather, the point is ma'avoda hazot lachem. Ma'atareach hazesh ma'trichen aleinu b'chol shana v'shana. Why are you commemorating Passover year after year? You don't need Passover anymore. There already was a Last Supper. That all of this already took place. You don't need this anymore. And you realize now what Reb Chiya did is he took an old teaching, which is talking about Christianity, and he updates it. By the way, now, for us, it doesn't mean anything anymore. Because for us, all of this is long forgotten, and Christianity left and separated, became a separate religion long ago, and that's what they were being warned about by the time of Rabbi Yishmael. Either you're with us at the time that we need, either at our time of need we're together, and we are brothers and we fight together, or what do we have holding us together? So I'm saying the message over here becomes such an interesting message, and one which you would think, oh, this is just purely academic. And the answer is, it's not. There is something else which is going on. Okay, I'm going to try to wind down, and I want to point at one more thing, and then we'll be finished. In Source 18, which is, again, a series of verses that we should be familiar with, this is the beginning of Parshat Va'era. Moshe complains that things deteriorated, they didn't get better. And then God says, no, go and tell them as follows. Lechamor levnei Yisrael, ani Hashem, votzeti etchem mitachat zivlat Mitzrayim. I'm going to take them out. Vitzalti etchem, I'm going to save them. Vaga'alti etchem, redeem them. Vlakachti etchem, and I'm going to take them. And we know this as the four languages of Geula, the four expressions of redemption. And some of us are actually a little bit more sophisticated. We also know that this is where the four cups of wine comes from, at least, by the way, according to one opinion. So we have four cups of wine, and all of that makes perfect sense. In Source 19, Tanu Rabbanan, the Gemara says, Revi, for that fourth cup, Gomer Elavata Halel. We say the Halel over the fourth cup. But Omer Halel Agadol, we say the great Halel. Div Rabbi Tarfon, that's what Rabbi Tarfon says, and we're just going to leave it at that. Rashi says, and this should be the beginning of alerting you that something is going on. Hachi Gersinan, this is the right way to read it. Now, if he's telling you this is the right way to read it, what does Rashi know? That there's another way to read it. That he's telling you don't read it the other way. Hachi Gersinan, Revi Gomer Tahalel, Omer Tahalel Agadol, exactly the way that we just now read it. And the Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, says, Hachi Gersinan, this is how you should read it. Tanur Banan Revi. The Rif, however, in source number 22 writes, Tanur Banan, Chamishi, Omer Alav Halal Gadol. On the fifth cup, you say the Halal, the great Halal. And that was what was in the text that Rashi told us, don't read it that way. By the way, essentially, it was the Sephardic Rishonim had five. In Bavel, they had five. It may actually even be a distinction between Sura and Pumbedita, if that helps anyone. But there was two different traditions, four cups or five cups. Now you're left to every single scholar and rabbi to figure out where in the world this came from, where in the world this went, what is going on with this. I actually, before I went to sleep last night, I remembered that I had a book written by a rabbi who spent 20 years in South Africa. So I opened it, and I knew that he had a chapter on this. It was, anybody remember the name? Rabbi Alter Hillowitz. Okay, I wasted my time last night opening the book. But he was one of the biggest Talmidei Chachamim who lived in South Africa. And he was there, again, long, long, long ago. And it was good. Reading what he wrote refreshed my memory about this. But let me, again, I want to skip a little. There's this tension. One of the resolutions, which you already see in the Rambam, and the Rambam knows the text, that it's five, but the Rambam's resolution is that what we do, you pour the fifth cup, but you don't drink the fifth cup. And what do we call that? Koso shel Eliyahu. I always knock the legs of the table, so some of the wine spills, and he said, the grandchildren, what happened over here? Eliyahu came, and yeah, he came, whatever. I'll probably do it again this year. But they may be on to me already. So do we have the fifth cup, or do we not have a fifth cup? But, so I'll tell you right now, some people had a custom of drinking the fifth cup. Some people thought it was allowed. Some people thought, if you want a name attached to those who think that it's an absolute obligation, in the mission says you give even the poorest portion four cups. In 23, the Ran writes, Katav Rav Zecharia Halevi, the Baal HaMa'or, Zald Rabbi Tafra, Namat Nidam Pligi. He argues, says, no, you don't give four cups, you give five cups. He believes there are five cups. So I'm saying a lot of Rishonim felt there are five cups, but I want to turn the page over and look at the way the Ravid, and it's not clear what he means. In source 25, Garsina bi Yerushalmi, Arba Kosot Halalu, Keneged Arba Gulot, Shenem Rubim Mitzrayim Votzeti. That the four cups are about the four languages inclusive. Rabbi Tarfun Hayamei Vichamishi, Keneged Veheveti. Because if you go back and look again in source 18, in Pasachet, there's a fifth language of redemption, and that is Vaiveti Tchem al Aretz, I brought you to the land. So I don't know how to nuance this properly. So I'll just say it like this. Apparently, there are those who felt that if we're not in the land of Israel, you can't have that fifth cup, and you can't say Vaiveti. You can't experience the Vaiveti. As a matter of fact, somebody who comes really close to saying this is in source 29, the Torah Tumima. He writes, Zumash lo tiknu koso da'a le'inyan ve'veti etchem al aretz, de'ein loma m'nesha einu m'inyan agula. You can't say that that's not part of redemption. Coming to the land of Israel is part of the redemption. Shere kamokein tiknu le'inyan ve'lakachti etchem la'am, shugam kin einu m'inyan gula. Yesh loma poshu m'nesha b'yotenu ata b'galut. Torah Tumima very sadly writes, by the way, Torah Tumima, he actually lived in New York for a while. He lived in Brooklyn. He lived in Brooklyn, and then he went back to Europe, and he died in Europe. I'm not sure if he was killed in the Holocaust, but I believe he died in 1939. He went back. He says, now, which you attain atabi galut, the aretz misurabi yidei zarim, and the land is given over in the hands of strangers. Iyef shar lisakos yayin alze. We can't take that fifth cup. We can't do it. It's just not true. Lisa kosel ze vulai lezeche ze tiknu kos miuchad l'shmo shaliyo lisa korona l'remez she'anu mikavim l'viato tchiyatu ma'av aritz b'meir b'yameinu. He goes, maybe that's why they made the fifth cup, so we should have a hint that maybe the day is going to come that we can go back. So you know what? We should definitely pour the fifth cup. And all of us who've merited to live in Israel, maybe even we should drink a fifth cup. Maybe even we should be able to experience that. And if you say, but what about tradition? You know, where's Tevye saying that tradition? Well, I think the one thing that we've seen today is how tradition has changed and how we try to make the Seder meaningful. And again, we've succeeded and we've made it meaningful in every generation. Maybe in this generation, we need to do a little bit more in order to experience what the Torah to me wrote not all that long ago, that he couldn't imagine that one day we can keep it. He goes, of course we stopped doing this. Of course it doesn't resonate. Of course it's not true. But for us, it is true. Baruch Hashem.